Hello, I'm Eunji Ju, Director and Curator of Education and Public Programs at the New Museum and the curator of the 2012 New Museum Triennial, The Ungovernables. When we began thinking about the 2012 Triennial, it became very clear that in order to talk about a generation or to think about a generation of artists, that I would need to do a lot of research. Because it had been some time since I had been in the studios of younger artists, and also because in my conversations with colleagues in the last 5+ years, I had been hearing a lot about really incredible scenes happening in Egypt, in Argentina, in Mexico, in Korea, some places that I had already done research and some places that I had never been. I had long wanted to go, for example, to Indonesia, and I had long wanted to travel to South Africa. And this was a great excuse to go to cities in these countries and learn about what was happening there in the local art scenes. Beginning the research, I think what was crucial I started around 2009, was a period that I called the pre-research period, because I felt that even in order to determine who would be participating or what that might look like, I needed to get information. And so initial trips to Hong Kong, Hanoi, Ho Chi Minh City, Bangkok, those research trips were actually done kind of prior to any existing framework for the triennial, and they definitely helped to shape how we would move forward. In addition, I think in that year I did some studio visits in Mexico and in the United States, in several different cities in the United States, as well as I didn't start the research yet, but I started to pay a little bit more attention to what was going on in places like Lebanon and also Cairo. We just started to open my eyes a little bit. Also in 2008, I first went to India, and that research would later kind of come back to help frame some of the initial ideas for the triennial.
Hi everyone, my name is Gabriel Sierra, and in the piece, in the exhibition, I was just to play the game with the museum. I want to use the pieces that the installation crew used to install artworks. The ladder, the level, the piece of wood, and the table. And I was trying to figure out how this connect the relation between the spectator and the architectural space of the museum. But at the same time, playing the game of, you expected to find pictures and drawings in the walls. But other important thing for me is the relation of the body with the things. It sounds quite redundant, but for my work, it's very important, no? How we relate with things. I'm not interested in the architecture. I'm most interested in the space that we create to live. No, it's in the ordinary sense. And I discovered that when people ask me why or how I made the installation in the place, I'm more interested in how I made it than how it means. But I think that the most important thing of the art is that it doesn't have a specific function. This is my favorite thing of the art. The art could be everything or nothing. I think it's the most important mystery of art. In other cases, for example, the architecture or the engineering, they have a very complex social function. The art looks like not have a very complex social function. And with this kind of things or this kind of ideas, I try to to make questions about what is an object, or what is the devil, or what is the function of place things in the space, or what is the function of spectators in the museum. Why the museum have spectators or visitants, and why the museum have, what is the meaning of to be an artist today? I think it's a, I try to make this question every day. Why is the meaning of to be an artist now? We have, I think the concept of artists of today is very different from the concept of artists of the 70s or 60s. Now, what is the role of this profession? Or it's good to think it's arts as a profession or a kind of work. I don't know how to approach it, but for me, it's very important to try to understand what is the role of the artist of today.
My name is Ala Yunus, and I am from Jordan. I'm participating in the Ungovernables exhibition, or the New Museum Triennial, with a piece that came, or that was developed from a publication project on soldiers. So it all started with an installation of miniature soldiers that were casted and hand-painted especially for my project. From that, parallel to that project, I was researching Middle Eastern soldiers in specific, I was working towards developing a publication on contemporary Middle Eastern soldiers, and not necessarily the soldiers that are fighting in official soldiers who are registered in an army or who are on the front, who are shooting at people, as much as people who were raised with background and readiness to fight. So this is more the focus of my project. So it's a publication project based on found material and also on invited contributions between artists, writers, soldiers, ex-soldiers. So it's the contributors to the project can be as wide as the existence of a soldier itself. And so it's not necessarily just on soldiers, it's on fighters or on ready-made fighters or ready to become fighters. So this is the first time that the publication project is not printed yet, it's still in development. It started in 2010 and still in development. And so in these 2 years, I've been coming across many interesting stories that are almost unbelievable on soldiers, on fighters, on people that had inherited such a legacy or such an experience or such a training. For this exhibition, we brought together we pulled out from the publication project five projects or five contributions. So all in all, this is not just the public. This is not the publication, but this is like a segment, was like a selection of it. I mean, this is in general what relates all these works together. But then each work corresponds in a different way with the other. So there is this circular, or like this very general way to look at the whole exhibition. And then there are certain things that links. First of all, the works to each other, but also to link us personally to these things.
Hu Xiaoyuan from China.
I'm so sorry, my English is so bad.
Then I translate. Okay.
Thank you. 最初的想法在08年的时候，我画过很多简单形态的，像是木板一样的一些形态的类似的作品。当时的想法其实就是源于一个对于在中国的观念里有一个很古老的说法是关于空性的。
When she started that series, just started from tiny pieces of wood, and then she didn't even have any particular idea or concept behind it.
然后最初的时候，我去画那些木头的时候，画的是那些木头上的纹路，我所能看到的，我把它们画在顶上的这个透明的层面上，但是我能看到的 和真的存在的我所没看到的这些东西是非常的有差异的。
When she mounted the silk paper on the wood and then started to paint it, right after the first few pieces, and then she realized that even though she's kind of imitated the wood pattern on the original wood, and then she realized that there's huge differences, actually huge differences in between the pattern and what is real and fake, no forgery.
所以说我画的可能是那个木纹，也有可能。跟那个木头没有什么太多的关系，我画完了之后已经完全不是那个样子了，是有差异的，或者说画的到底是不是那个木头，这个都已经是一个问题。
Actually, she's painting or drawing the pattern of the original wood, but she thought actually the differences is the main point of it. And
然后当现在展出的这组作品产生的时候，我觉得。我开始有另外的一些想法，就是这个想法是对于阐释作品这件事儿，我认为是非常不必要的一个过程。阐释就是去解释，自我去解释这个作品。
After
就是在这个作品，就在完成这个作品之后，我开始发现。
Right after she finished this set of work on second floor, she started to realize actually to explain.Explain the work is not necessary and not important.
所以我觉得就是艺术家的阐释是件无聊的事情，然后我觉得真正所有的人跟这个世界建立联系都是靠自己的意志和感知，然后我觉得去观看艺术作品的人可能他会有他自己的一个体系，这个才是最重要的。作品一旦产生之后就已经脱离了艺术家的控制，所以现在无论我说什么其实就跟放屁一样，听不听都无所谓。
OK, she said actually to show the word is meaningless because when you start the work, actually, it's all about the existence of the material and the work itself. So to show it, actually, is meaningless. Because it's all about the perception of artwork of an artist, and its process actually is not happening in the exhibition itself. But in the exhibition, how the audience is to view the artwork is...
就是每个人，因为对观众自己都是靠自己的感知和就是视觉
okay,
或者是跟这个世界建立联系
okay,
所以跟我不太有关系。
OK, so how do audiences interpret or perceive her works actually is none of her business.
So I'm Pilvi Takala, I come from Finland. So the piece is based on this 1 month I spent in Deloitte, in this, it's a multinational company but they have an office in Helsinki.And I got an opportunity to get a job there, which I wouldn't ever get with my skills. So it was an opportunity to be part of this working community. And for me, that kind of situation is super interesting. And especially a workplace is something most people have to deal with somewhere. So it's a kind of really common ground. But for me, to work in this kind of corporate environment was really like something I couldn't reach myself.So the idea was just to be there and then see what to do more. So I had permission to film with hidden camera. And only a few people knew who I am really. So most of the people were told I'm Johanna Takala, my second name. And yeah, different background information. So yeah, I just observed how people work, how people fit in.And what's going on, what's the social regulations in the space. And after a few weeks, I got the idea of working a bit differently, like a really silent way to change the method, but something that I knew would be not accepted fully in this place. First, I just wanted to be part of that group as normal as possible member, so you just copy what everybody's doing. And then,I tried to find something that would kind of negotiate the rules a bit further, like this gray area where there are no rules exactly for that kind of behavior, of course, but people just tend to not do it because you feel that it's not so okay. And that seemed like, so it was very yeah, simple. I just decided to stop working physically and claim that I'm working inside my head. And I started in my own desk, and then I moved around the company also to kind of reach different people. And the elevator was the last thing, which I then kind of reached the whole office. So it slowly, yeah, expanded. And people in the end all knew about this trainee who's working in a weird way. And then you could also in the end see how differently people responded. Like some people were even interested, like, oh, that's really, how often do you do this? It's an interesting way to work. Or they would just be scared of me and they would think I'm crazy. And that's something I never wanted to, I tried my best not to appear crazy. But if nobody talks to you, then it's not easy to explain yourself. So if people just start to avoid and not to ask for lunch anymore and just stare at you and never say anything, then it's hard to kind of tell them, I'm okay, I'm doing this on purpose, I have an explanation why I do this. So when I moved around, I could explain, some people were actually patient enough to ask what are you doing and why, even though the answer wouldn't be so clear, but it would be an answer.
My name is Munira Al-Salah, and I'm actually here to help Bassam to install his works. It's his work that we see now. He made the drawings each time he had to wait for something or someone. He just wanted to use the time as a positive time instead of thinking about it as a dead time. So he, you know, I'm very close with him, and then it's simple, so I could come here and help him out to install it. Yeah, he actually works in a juice shop, so he, you know, you can imagine he wakes up early in the morning to wash the fruits, prepare the shop, cut everything, press some things in advance, just like any other juice shop, actually, of this kind in Beirut. So that's his daily life is like this, and then he also goes, sometimes he even delivers the juices to some places. I feel that the colors could be, you know, influenced by the juices that they make. A lot of the people from his neighborhood come to buy juice, like the pharmacist, the bicycle shop guy, the I don't know who. And he has another series of works where he drew each one of these guys. It's a bit like the socio-realistic kind of painting movement, if you want, that was especially between the two world wars in Europe. But even now, I was at the MoMA recently, and I saw they have even this socio-realistic style that was also done at a time when poverty was very high, and then it's also right after the war or something. So this is something that Bassam has been doing, even without maybe necessarily being conscious that this is like socio-realism, or some people call it new realism. It's not that he was drawing something beautiful, he was just, he made a sketch. This is from his sketchbook, you know, of depending on each situation while he was waiting for something. So it's really, you know, realistic in a way that he's drawing, perhaps he's drawing from his imagination, but it's the real moment while he was waiting for something to happen or for someone else, because he lives pretty much in a community, which is typical of the life over there. Or there's always a reason why to wait for something or someone. And he wanted to see the philosophical meaning of the waiting and having it like a time to process some ideas instead of having it like dead time or stressful time. It's like against modernity, it's like against the rush of modernity. So he starts to enjoy waiting.
My name is Gimang Waliuler. I live in Johannesburg, but I'm from Cape Town originally in South Africa. Actually, this work basically is a response to a performance work I did in 2008 in the same project space we used to work in the Shebeen in Cape Town. where I dug a hole with an Afro comb. It's called a pick here in the US. And I discovered a skeleton. And so I've been always curious about like the skeleton and as a form of archive, this archaeology, and but also because of the result of what happened when I discovered the skeleton, there was a dialogue which happened. And people were telling stories about how, you know, this came to be, and like the kind of they painted a picture of the time period, which something I've always enjoyed, like telling stories and both listening to stories. So this would be it's a continuation. It's part of something I'm working on at the same time, which is a play. Hopefully, I don't know how it's going to take shape yet. But I'm treating all of these as sketches, in a sense, to construct a play one day. And here there are various narratives in this drawing, ranging from rituals, which I hope to perform for the bones which I discovered. Like for example, where it says buttons to be burned. That's a ritual which is practiced after someone has died. After a certain period of time, they take all the buttons from their clothes and burn them. But the bones I found are not human bones, right? And this is usually done for humans. The bones I found were that of a cow, right? But I would still like to perform this gesture, you know, like this symbolic gesture towards releasing the spirit of like these bones, and but also to try and move them forward into like my work as well. And so there's a lot of like there is that like this kind of text on walls, and which are supposed to act as instructions, but also the kind of markers of something. I don't know how to call it, but I look at them as a particular archive, an unconventional form of archive, at least those public texts, because they reflect a particular point in time, be it under political circumstances. The type of text that you see, for example, during times of war, reflect war context or situations. So I've also always been curious about the kind of texts that appear after moments of war. Even though I never grew up in the war in South Africa, because since apartheid, we didn't have like a formal war where, but there were still a lot of texts which were put on the walls, which were responses to government, the laws, to the infrastructure, just to the political context of the time in various ways. Yeah, so again, I'm interested in like this activating something else in the future. And the work is titled Remembering the Future of a Whole as a Verb. So the work becomes like some form of activating something beyond what is seen here. Hopefully one day it'd be a play, more performances, installation or sculptural works.
Iman Issa. In terms of this series, it started. I started conceiving of it in 2009. So it took quite a long time. And I mean, with this exhibition now, the series is done. And actually, when I started the series, I was kind of, it came out of other work. Like I was kind of looking at ways to kind of represent something about familiar places, events, and figures. And I started to look at monuments and memorials and their capacity to do that, so actually to recall the subject matter that they claim to commemorate. So this was mainly my interest. And Before, I always had a kind of a certain skepticism about the language of monuments and memorials. I thought it was quite simplistic. I didn't really believe it worked very much. But then at one point, I felt I wanted to take a closer look at this. And doing that, I actually started to think that actually maybe not. Maybe monuments and memorials could be a very adequate way of speaking about the figures, the events, the places they commemorate. And I mainly look to monuments and memorials that I grew up with. so that we're, you know, commemorating figures, events, or places that were part of my personal history. And having done that, I came up with two conclusions. One of them was, yes, I think the language is really interesting, and mainly the symbolic quality, but also the abstracting tendencies. And the second was, like, I felt with the particular monuments I was looking at, I didn't really feel that they were able to capture something adequate or significant about the figures, events, places they commemorated, so I came up with the idea of offering alternative forms.
Rayan Tabet, this is the first chapter of a story that is part of the catalog that I wrote with a friend of mine. His name is John Greenberg. And the story title is 1989. One morning, after fetching a glass of water to wash away his sleep, Rami Kachaduri opened his bedroom door and nearly tumbled one story down to the floor below. In the time that it had taken to fill his glass from the tap, Rami's bedroom had vanished. Teetering on the edge of the door sill, Rami clutched the doorknob. He blinked twice. Up and down, east and west, walls, floor, and ceiling had ceased to exist. A gust of wind, sweeping off the street outside, caught the door and forced him back to firmer ground. Rami unclenched his fist and allowed the door to swing unfettered over the empty space where the bedroom floor had been. Inspecting the perimeter of the void, he observed that the room had disappeared as neatly as a piece of cake sliced away from the pan. The walls had been sheared away and their crisp masonry corners exposed and neatly cut, as with a razor. Layers of plaster and mesh were trimmed precisely at the edges, and the tangles of electrical wire appeared snipped, their circuits cut short. Where the ceiling had been sliced away, Rami counted the ribbons of flooring that had accumulated above the cement slab: linoleum, tile, and later, in the 70s, carpet. Peering past the edge of the door sill, Rami spied his downstairs neighbor, Mr. Salim Shadi, from apartment 1F, stretch and flutter his eyes open, only to gaze sleepily at the chandelier swinging from the ceiling two floors above. The man sighed and tossed himself out of bed and into his slippers before shuffling across the room in his undergarments and out the door beneath Rami's feet. The screech of rusted shower knobs drew Rami's attention to the left. Soapy water erupted from a waste pipe and landed with a dull thud against the carpet floor of Mr. Shadi's bedroom before spreading in a sudsy blotch. Lifting his eyes, Rami saw that the wall between his bedroom and the apartment's only bathroom had also disappeared. His mother's dressing gown hung from the back of the bathroom door, and Rami lifted his eyes hesitantly, but Mrs. Kachaduri had already drawn the shower curtain shut. An uneasy queasiness crept into his knees, and vertigo sloshed through his head. Turning away from his bedroom, he stepped across the hall and collapsed against the reassuring solidity of the opposite wall. As Rami assessed the damage caused by the disappearance of his bedroom, he noticed that even the wall on which his bedroom door had hung was gone, so that the door frame stood like a ruined arch at the precipice of the hallway edge. Indeed, of the four walls defining the hallway perimeter, only Rami's bedroom wall had disappeared. What would his parents say? Rami's hands began to tremble. Studying his palms, he attempted to discern within them the latent power that could make matter disassemble. Closing his eyes, Rami raised his hands and attempted to force his will through his fingertips. He grunted and sweated, swore and stamped his foot, but when he opened his eyes, the bedroom door still stood lonely against the backdrop of the street beyond. Rami lowered his offending hand. Guilt settled over his shoulders as he made the observation that sometimes what is done cannot be undone. Succumbing to this realization, he was about to pout when a crash surprised him from his brooding. A kicking wind had slammed his bedroom door shut. Down the hall, the master bedroom door swung open, and Rami's father stepped into the hall with the morning's newspaper held open at his side. "Rami," he said, a frown curving deeply over his cigarette, "how many times?" But Rami already knew that he was about to be accused of slamming the door, and his ears stopped up with the injustice of it all. Mr. Kachaduri began walking down the hall. the butt of his cigarette clung to his lip and its lit end swung erratically like a cherry in the wind. As he neared, the newspaper's headline came into focus and Rami read, "Business as usual." Midway down the hall, the bathroom door was flung open from within and Rami's father was forced to leap aside. For one seemingly infinite moment, he balanced precariously at the edge of the floor where the hallway had been cut away. Before Rami could cry out, his father pivoted deftly on one foot and landed squarely in front of his wife. "Mrs. Khachaturi," he said, his impossibly deep frown drawing even deeper eye. But his words were suddenly caught in the roar of a truck engine passing by. Rami's mother smiled. In her bathrobe, she shivered against the breeze drifting across the void of Rami's bedroom. She took her husband's arm and led him down the hall. "Good morning, Rami," she said. "Mama, Baba, good morning," Rami said before stuttering an incomprehensible jumble of words that failed to describe his situation in even the most abstract terms. "What's that, dear?" Rami's mother said. Unable to explain the disappearance of his bedroom, and without a word even to describe it, Rami pointed a quivering finger toward his bedroom door. Mr. Khachaturi's eyebrows arched. He stepped toward the threshold and nudged the door open with his foot. Testing the empty space of the floor with his toe, Mr. Khachaturi grasped the door jamb and swung over the empty space. "Rami," he said, "you better run and tell Mr. Shadi to fetch a bucket."
My name is Tuan Andrew Nguyen. This is my collaborator, Matt Lucero. We work in a collective called the Propeller Group, based out of Ho Chi Minh City and Los Angeles.
What's interesting in Ho Chi Minh City, when I first got there 2.5 years ago, I had all these perceptions. I grew up in Los Angeles, in California, so I have all these perceptions of what socialism is and Marxism and communism based on media, based on my own education, based on conversations. I've never actually been to a communist country, socialist country. This was my first time. So I had all these preconceived notions about what that meant. And I get to Ho Chi Minh City Airport, and I see the hammer and sickle flag. I see these tropes. I see these icons are everywhere. AK-40, it's very militaristic. So it was feeding into what I thought was this idea. I'm going traveling to the place where I'm staying and go through the center of the city. And I'm greeted by Louis Vuitton, Kenneth Cole, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Coffee Bean, and realize very quickly that this is it's a really interesting place, and where you can see an advertisement of Coca-Cola right next to a Ho Chi Minh City, Ho Chi Minh propaganda. I think what's interesting is the power of advertising and media, and the colonization that can happen through that medium. And I think it does happen, and I think we're interested in that. And I think this is kind of a way of us playing with that those strategies a little bit and questioning those strategies in terms of the specificity of it existing in Ho Chi Minh City, but also just it existing everywhere and how it affects us positively, negatively, in all sorts of ways.
Hi, this is Slavs and Tatars, and we're an art collective founded in 2006, devoted to an area east of the former Berlin Wall and west of the Great Wall of China. We often work between sort of these two twin goalposts that are geographical, but also ideological goalposts of communism and Islam as the two sort of major geopolitical narratives of the 20th and 21st centuries. Preiwe is a new piece, the first in our new cycle of work called the Faculty of Substitution, where we look at the idea of devoting oneself to others' beliefs or devoting one's life or one's work to another set of beliefs or another set of peoples in an effort to reach a sense of self-awareness or self-knowledge, basically challenging the notion that the best route between two points is the shortest distance. Preiwe is inspired by two types of sort of architecture. One is the riverbed, or kind of a flat version of Preiwe, which we find across tea salons and restaurants and kiosks and pit stops and at the entrances of mosques across Central Asia. And the other structure that it is inspired by is called a rahle, or book stand, that often has the book facing the sky or facing God, in a sense, often used for holy books. So Prayway brings these two forms together in an effort to kind of question certain notions of reading as a sort of sacred practice, as public space in areas in the world where often public space is circumscribed, such as in Iran. The lighting also resembles a kind of customization you find underneath cars in the United States. We often try to bring two antithetical or seemingly antithetical or mutually exclusive points together, in this case, kind of questions of mysticism with very vernacular language of these seating salons or sort of collective seating, as well as these the customization of lighting. Prayway also offers a different kind of seating arrangement, which is collective as opposed to the kind of individual seating that we find in most Western countries. Instead of having the kind of the delineation of chairs, individual chairs and tables, or on Prayway, a collective or sort of a group of people can sit together and converse or sip tea or smoke a shisha. So we invite people to sit down and lie down on it, to take a break, talk, read a book. In fact, what we try in a lot of our work is to reach this question, this point of sort of generosity that allows, that's basically kind of a humor or a kind of an openness or an inclusiveness that we find is often missing from contemporary political discourse.
I'm Julia Dalt. I live in Brooklyn, New York. So the sculptures are made mostly of mirrored plexiglass or just standard plexi and often formica. And formica is this, many people know it from tabletops in the 1950s, vintage tables. And it has this underside, which in one of the sculptures you can see, that kind of raw underside. And yeah, it's not a typical material you'd find, say, in a fine art sculptor. But that is part of the appeal. Many of the pieces themselves are salvaged, like I find them at salvage yards in Long Island City or in Jersey. And so they have these scratches or marks on them, or while I'm building, they get more scratched and more marked up, but that's part of the process of the making, because I want the viewer to be able to understand that labor was involved in this, how this thing came to be. And I also like the idea that these materials have a life before they were destined or to be victimized by being a sculpture, that so they have these scrapes and bumps. With the sculptures and the paintings, I'm really interested in having someone, letting them know sort of the evolution of the form. So you can look at a sculpture and think, oh, okay, I see, this is bent at the bottom and it's knotted here and there's another layer on top and it's affixed to the wall. And with the painting too, you can see, okay, the swoop from some sort of tool was made here and she picked off here. And like you can in some way trace it. And in highfalutin art speak, I sometimes call that like anti-illusionism. But really it's just to try to be as direct as I possibly can be. What I do is find the materials at salvage yards or Canal Plastics, which is this amazing place around the corner, and bring an assortment of colors here, and then decide based on the space I've been given, the number of sculptures I have to make, for example, what those combinations will be. And I know how the materials behave now. For example, if you bend formica too far, as a material, it will snap, and the edges are really sharp. So it has its limits, right? And plexi will only kind of bend so far, or you can only really tether it so far before it becomes too unruly. So what I like to say is that I, as a body and of like a physical being, I have my capabilities, and then it has its kind of material capabilities or qualities. And what ends up happening is kind of this meeting point between those two things.
Mariana Teixeira. Básicamente, le puse días de verdad.
¿Cómo?
El título del trabajo es Día de Verdad.
The title of the work is Days of Truth.
O días en lo que todo parece verdad.
Or days in which everything seems like the truth.
Es diferente.
It's different.
Es un poco pensando justamente cuando estoy metida en ese mundo de estar haciendo.
I was thinking about it when I'm sort of inside that world of making.
Considero ese tiempo como uno de los tiempos para mí.
I understand that time as a time for myself.
Más reales.
More real.
Y más verdaderos. O sea,
and truthful.
Lo vivo con mucha.
I live them with a lot of.
De una manera muy genuina.
Of a very in a very genuine
eso.
Way.
Y casi intuitiva.
Almost
o sea,
intuitive.
A veces trabajo con
sometimes
con
I
ideas
work with ideas
o intentando resolver ideas con
or trying to
objetos,
solve ideas with objects
o situaciones
or situations
que están a un metro de del alcance de mi mano
that are, sea, are like around, like a meter away from my hand
intento de hacer con eso
and
algo
and I try to make something out of it
y,
or with it
pero de una manera muy 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 intuitiva, o
but
sea,
in a very intuitive
muy,
way.
Muy real, o
very
sea,
real.
No puedo evitar
I cannot help
el amor por los objetos y
loving those objects.
Las posibilidades infinitas
and the possibilities, the infinite possibilities
que me plantean todo el tiempo. Es insoportable para mí.
That they give me all the time. It's almost
sí,
unbearable.
Es insoportable.
It
es como
is unbearable.
Que me siento sumamente demandada
I feel very demanded
por las cosas.
By these things.
Además, o sea, no me gusta agregarle complejidad
I don't like to make it sound more complex
a esa relación que tengo
to
con
that
ellos.
Relationship es, that I have with
complico
the objects.
Todo lo demás, lo complico muchísimo.
I complicate
muchísimo.
Everything else.
Todo. Ellos no, los objetos no te hablan.
But the objects do not
de
speak
esa
to
manera,
you in that
como,
way.
Y no piensan en la muerte.
And they don't think about death.
No piensan en para
they
siempre.
They don't think about forever.
Y mucho menos en hijos. Pero,
and they don't think about having kids.
Pero creo
but
que
I
bueno,
think
un poco
that,
ese es mi método.
That is my method.
You know, when I talk about this exhibition, I often discuss these resonances that I feel between the works and between the artists, as well as what I would describe as a conversation that these artists were having before they ever saw each other's work or met each other. And this was probably the strongest, like, intuitive feeling that I had in my research, was that there was a generational conversation happening, they just didn't know it yet. And it's not that we discovered it by any means, but that we could bring together some of the work and some of the people so that they could have that we could literally help to initiate, you know, a personal conversation that by all expectations should continue for the next 20 to 40 years given their ages. And, you know, this is from Hong Kong to Bogota, from Rosario to Cape Town. I saw resonances between this generation, some of which are not present in the exhibition itself. But I think once the exhibition came together and you saw the literal kind of visual conversation between works formally and the oral conversation that you can't miss on the second floor because it's quite loud, you know, I think that other people also started to really pick up on the actual, you know, relationship between different works in the exhibition. And I think those relationships sometimes occur within the proximity of one floor, or one area of a floor, and sometimes from, you know, the second floor to the fourth floor. And these were intentional, but they were, I would say, largely intuitive, and therefore when you could feel them in a tactile way in the space, it also had a little bit of a surprise to it.
Adrián Villarrojas. Yeah, well, when I think about this piece in particular and also maybe about my practice, I feel kind of a responsibility of being doing these things now. I mean, be claiming the role or profession of being an artist. Because, I mean, I really feel the pressure and the weight of history, and I really feel the pressure of having at least something, a little micro particle of information to the art world. You know, I mean, it's very important for me. And I think it's kind of nice, this feeling of not having a direct way to relate to the piece that's on the fourth floor, because what I was, you know, we're trying to say, I mean, in this kind of, I mean, kind of situation where I put myself with this lot of pressure about finding something to say, I was like, maybe I should find a new space. Maybe I should not be any more interested in a way in this era. So I thought maybe I should go further and then start again and bring things from further distances, maybe time, space, further distances, and bring them back here. This is the first time that this piece stands against other, I mean, in a museum and with other artists, which was also very interesting for me. Because I never think about exhibitions. I mean, I never think of these works as not even needing of public, because in a way for me, when these pieces are, whenever these pieces come from, there's no more even humans. So, but also that brings the question of the reader and who should be reading that. Maybe there's absolute silence and nobody should be reading this. I think it's good that there's no direct way, again, to relate to these works. But also it's good that they, in a way, stage this idea of our generation. I mean, how we see future. Also, in a way, because of course it's mediating with lots of references, and it also shows us how fragile these kind of representations we build of the future are, because they will change in 10 years, and in 20, and in 30, because every generation has an idea of the future. No matter how hard I try it, I will fail.
In the context of this exhibition, The title of the exhibition really came out of a research trip that I took in 2010 from kind of late October to mid-November of 2010, which began in Cairo and included Alexandria, Cairo and Alexandria, Egypt, and then continued on to Harare, Zimbabwe, and then to Johannesburg and Cape Town, South Africa. And during that trip, I met a lot of artists and a lot of cultural producers. There was also a symposium in Cairo at that time about archives, and also a meeting of the Museum as Hub partner curators, which was directed at shaping, you know, the future of the Museum as Hub, but also served as the first meeting of the official advisors to the triennial. And there were a lot of things that we began to think about from that meeting, including specific artists who I was, you know, told that I should start looking at. I think, you know, this is also being in the context of Cairo. I took the most amazing walk with Ayman Ramadan, who is an artist based in Cairo, who has worked with us here in the new museum as a Museum as Hub Fellow and also as an exhibiting artist. And Ayman walked me around the downtown area, very close to where the townhouse is located and very close to Tahrir Square, and told me about the informal architecture in that neighborhood and how local people who lived there were being denied permits in order to keep their houses from falling down, you know, just to make basic improvements. And he told me about how the price of sugar and the price of tomatoes had gotten so high that everyday people really, you know, were struggling to just feed their families. And we drove one day with our group to the university, and we saw this military vehicle, kind of a riot truck. And I asked what that was, and they said, well, you know, the elections are coming in December, so this truck will be parked here through the elections to remind us that, you know, of the presence of the military. And this really stuck in my head. And so when I went to South Africa and was visiting places like the Apartheid Museum and the Hector Peterson Museum, and meeting dozens of amazing cultural producers, artists, curators, designers, and also, you know, kind of thinking about their emergence in the kind of post-apartheid period, and thinking about, you know, certain terms that I had known before but had forgotten, that had been used, you know, in terms of the Soweto uprisings in 1976. This all kind of came into my head together, and with the curator Gabby Nkobo, who's based in Johannesburg, we started to talk about the larger context of South Africa quite a bit. And I think by the time I came home, it was clear that this term of ungovernability was, you know, would be really useful in bringing things together, which I was concerned with, that have to do with the inheritance of the generation. Not so much what the generation had accomplished or struggled through, but in the aftermath of certain situations like the Soweto uprisings or like the economic crises in the 1980s in Latin America or the 1990s in Korea or the post-revolutionary struggles and the dictatorships, you know, things that some of these artists experienced firsthand and things that they experienced kind of secondhand through their body memories or through the stories in their families or the repressed stories that no one would talk about. You know, I thought that there were some relationships between these experiences and certain formal issues in the work and certain issues with regards to how content was being dealt with.
So I'm Jonatas de Andrade. I live in Recife, Brazil, and I'm presenting here the Tropical Hangover, Ressaca Tropical, which is a piece that puts together these found diary with a lot of pictures of this city in different times. This diary was found by a friend of mine in the garbage, and it's a love diary. I was trying to create a fiction of a city that confounds destruction with construction. So I was trying to take these abandoned buildings and the destruction pictures not as failure, but as a possibility of reinventing itself. So the love diary gives strength as a libido of the city that explodes the buildings to restart all again. These modernism looked like imported somehow, but its ruin and its sort of abandonment looked like not most, it could look at first as a failure, but for me it was more like a settle down, as if it was like that when the nature started penetrating the building, and when it started being highly used through abandonment, it looked like as if it was really having its first roots in the place. So it starts really belonging. It started really being particular. So if I had one initial task for the piece, it was to reposition this idea of failure and error. Because in this state of things, in this fictional city or not, this failure was not a failure. It was about a climax of, as the libido in the diary, a climax of pleasure that it gives back to the city as a possibility of restarting or to leaving it very open.